In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Oh, you betcha. Let's all go back on Downtown. Lobby. Time to talk movies. Let's Alan Adams from The Main Edge is here with us in studio. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Happy Monday.
And to you as well.
You were just telling us the great news about Stella.
That's right. Yeah, we got word back on Friday. She got the all clear. She kind of side-eyes us a little bit. She's like, oh, so I went through all this for nothing. But no, it's a question of peace of mind.
Yes.
She's all good. We can only knock on wood and hope that it continues going forward. But
rock on, Stella.
It was pretty exciting.
Absolutely. How was the rest of your weekend?
It was good. We didn't get out a whole lot. We did attend the opening of the Without Borders art show at the University of Maine through the MFA students of the intermediate program up there present their work. It's still hanging in Lord Hall up there on campus. If anybody wants to check it out, it's very cool. Like Sheridan works with the department, and so she got to see the sort of final presented work of some of the students that she advises and stuff, and some pretty cool stuff. One of the great joys of Intermedia is, it's funny. The spouse of one of the UMaine administrators who came to see the show basically was like, I thought it would just be like paintings and stuff. And it's not. Like, they do a lot of interdisciplinary stuff, fabric art and sound art and all these wonderfully conceptual sorts of pieces. So yeah, it's up for a while yet. So if you happen to find yourself on campus and want to check it out, some pretty great stuff up there.
That's awesome. Well, listen, we got a lot of movies to get to, four of them this week. Where do we begin?
All right, we'll start with The Valet, which is currently streaming on Hulu, a remake of a French film from about 15 years ago. Stars Eugenio Derbez, Samara Weaving, and Max Greenfield. And it's pretty standard rom-com stuff. We've seen numerous versions of the, someone gets caught with the wrong person and so has to pretend that someone else is their, significant other.
Oh, yes.
You know the deal. And that's what this movie is. Derbez plays Antonio. He's a valet who parks cars for the rich and famous outside of a particularly trendy restaurant in Los Angeles. Olivia Allen, played by Samara Weaving, is one of the biggest movie stars in the world. She's on the verge. Her biopic of Amelia Earhart is on the verge of opening. But she is engaged in an affair with a married real estate mogul named Vincent, and that's Max Greenfield. And so they're involved in a tryst, and said tryst, Antonio inadvertently inserts himself into the middle of it due to inattention on his part. The paparazzi are there. They take photos. They get a picture of Olivia with Vincent together. Scandal threatens to erupt. And so they come up with a plan because Antonio also in the picture. And so they decide, we're going to pay this guy some money to pretend to be Olivia's boyfriend until this blows over and we can sort of get back to the way things were. And then hijinks. It's perfectly sweet. Like you can pretty much tell how it's going to go. It does not necessarily end in the way that these movies often end, which is kind of nice. But ultimately, like, we're not reinventing the wheel here. We're putting some nice tires on it maybe, but it's all very, very straightforward, charming, funny. Derbez is a very good actor, he's huge in Mexico, hasn't yet made as big a splash here as I think maybe he wants to. I love Samara Weaving. Max Greenfield is great. It's a lovely cast, a nice little movie. Nothing to write home about, but if you like this kind of thing, if you like a good romantic comedy, you should really check out The Valet because it's pretty solid.
All right, that's one of four. What's next?
All right, so let's talk about Downton Abbey, A New Era.
Which had a huge weekend at the box
and
office.
And great. Like, that's, I am always going to be here for adult movies for adults doing big business at the box office. Not adult movies. You know what I meant. And so Sheridan and I actually went to see this new one. It is written by Julian Fellowes, creator of the series, as well as he also wrote the script for the previous Downton Abbey film. You may remember when I spoke to you about that first film, I went into the Downton Abbey movie having never seen the show.
Right.
Like I have no, like, you know, like it was because it was so like culturally prominent in a way, by the way, I don't think a TV show is going to be again, just because of the, like, even in the few years since that show went off the air, the landscape has just continued to fracture. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know that we're going to see a lot of shows that capture the sort of attention of any section of the populace the way that one did. But anyway, so I went in, didn't know who anyone was really. I knew Maggie Smith, would occasionally pipe in with withering, pithy remarks.
Yes.
But that was about it. You'll be happy to know that Maggie Smith is also delivering withering, pithy remarks in A New Era. It's one of those things where I feel like these folks know what they're doing. Like, they are very aware of the kind of story they want to tell and the audience to whom they are telling it. This incarnation of the film is actually kind of split into two parts. You've got two very distinct storylines that are taking place in two distinct locations. You've got the one, you know, at the Abbey itself, where Lady Mary has agreed to let a film crew make a movie, a silent film in Downton Abbey in order to raise money to fix the roof. Like, that is the the studio throws a ton of money at them and they're like, all right, well, come. You've got, you know, film crews. Hugh Dancy plays the director. Dominic West is the leading man. And you've got a beautiful but sort of off-putting woman as the star of the film. This is a silent movie. We'll be back to that.
Okay.
And then the other storyline. The Dowager Countess has inherited a villa in the south of France. from a mysterious marquis that nobody had ever heard of and who she had not spoken to in over half a century.
A former paramour?
Well, I'm not going to say, Rich.
Oh, okay. All right.
But that is one of the immediate questions, as you might imagine. She inherits the villa. She decides that she's going to give it to one of her great-granddaughters, the one who is not necessarily in line to inherit in the same way that some of the other grandchildren are, just in order to sort of develop some sort of equity, which was, I thought, a very progressive move from Lady Violet. A bunch of the Downton folks, I'm not going to try to name their names, Rich. It was hard enough, like, going back and forth when I was writing the review. I certainly don't remember their names now. A big group, including the Lord of the Lord of the Manor, Hugh Bonneville, whatever his character's name
Lord
is.
Lord Crawley.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, man. And a bunch of their
group. Might have watched a lot of
that's fair.
That in my house.
And they actually go to France to see the villa and meet the new Marquis, the son of the deceased Marquis, and the Marquis's wife, who, as you might imagine, not super jazzed about the fact that her longtime husband, they were married for 50 years, has given away their villa to some rando. And so we have that conversation happening, which takes some very interesting turns as we go. And we basically just bounce back and forth between these two storylines. The movie making one is fun. We get the silent movie, but then they threaten to pull the funding, and so they decide to transition to a talkie. And that's when we find out that the beautiful, stunning silent actress talks like a gutter snipe. like she's got like that thick Cockney accent and struggles to get rid of it. They come up with a rather unique solution to that as well. And we just sort of move back and forth. And it is precisely what you expect a Downton Abbey movie to be. It's people with genteel manners dealing with these sorts of low stakes kinds of interactions. We're sort of past, I feel like we're sort of past the upstairs downstairs kind of culture clash that I think marked the series, as far as I understand. Everybody's pretty much on the like, the servants aren't necessarily treated with the sort of dismissive manner
part of the family, in a sense.
Yes, in a lot of ways. And you know, and there's all sorts of intricate subplots where, you know, so-and-so wants to marry so-and-so, but doesn't feel like they can until, you know, they have some sort of big success. There are some secretive trysts that are happening along the way. Look, everybody's dressed in, you know, glorious finery, and we've got big, giant, beautiful houses. Everybody's speaking very poshly, and... Look, it's not necessarily for me. I acknowledge not being the target audience for this movie, but I can recognize it as an extremely well-made example of what it is. And as you said, like, it proved very popular at the box office, and good, because it's the sort of movie that I think will be a far better indicator of box office health going forward than any sort of comic book movie, just because... I mean, they're just different animals.
Yeah, and you get some grown-ups going to the theater.
You know, and it's like, it's not like, you know, the box office isn't being propped up by, you know, by a contingent who go 4, 5, 6 times over the course of a weekend.
Right.
Like, these are just folks who loved the show, loved the previous movie, and just want to spend time with these people again. And in that respect, it is an incredibly successful project.
Excellent. Alan Adams with us talking movies here on Pass the Popcorn. What's next?
Let's talk men.
All right. The movie or men in general?
We'll talk about the movie.
Okay.
I'm not sure I'm an authority on men in general. This is going to be a kind of a difficult one to talk about, but we'll see what we can do. It's the third feature from writer-director Alex Garland. He did Ex Machina and Annihilation. And this movie stars Jessie Buckley as a woman who has gone to the English countryside as a way to sort of get away from a tragic instance happening in her own life. I won't get into the specifics. Like, it happens right at the beginning of the film, so it's not like it's a huge surprise, but I won't spoil it. But anyway, she makes her way to the village of Coston, rents this lovely little English cottage from a guy named Jeffrey, played by Rory Kinnear. She's basically just trying to get her life back together, like get her head back on straight, like find a way to sort of just disconnect from the trauma of these recent days. She shows up, it's beautiful, and she meets the guy. He's an eccentric, like full on, like little cap and like gumboots eccentric. You know what I'm talking about. She's like, this is great. Decides to go for a walk in the woods, and that's when things start to get a little weird. She's out in the woods. She finds this mysterious tunnel where she goes in, like an old railway tunnel. Sees someone off in the distance who starts like running towards her, so she kind of flees the scene, makes her way up through. Along the way, discovers a very naked fellow just sort of standing out in the field, staring. Runs home, calls her sister, is like, okay, so it's a little weird around here. And then the naked guy shows up in her yard. She calls the cops. Cops come and get the guy. She kind of thinks that's the end of it. You know, starts exploring the town, encounters, goes to visit a lovely church where she encounters a rather rude young man and the vicar. Goes to the local pub, has a drink. Jeffrey's there. She also encounters a number of other locals. I suppose this is the part where I should probably make clear. Everyone in this movie who is not Jesse Buckley is Rory Kinnear.
Whoa.
Like, all have Rory Kinnear's face.
Wow.
It's unsettling.
Hmm.
So you've got Jeffrey, of course, but... Weird naked guy, Rory Kinnear's face. Vicar, Rory Kinnear's face. Little boy, Rory Kinnear's face.
Oh.
Dudes at the bar, the cops, everybody. Every man in this place has Rory Kinnear's face. And Well, as you might imagine, it gets weird from there. In ways that I both don't feel comfortable explaining due to spoilers, and don't feel necessarily fully capable of explaining, because, like I said, this is not a traditional narrative in any real sense. It is much more, call it a visual metaphor or an allegory or something like that. We also have there are some pretty intense sort of, I don't know, I guess you'd call it folk horror, but like those sorts of weird sort of that sort of weird imagery interspersed throughout. For whatever reason, all of these men in this town, they bear some sort of grudge against against Harper, our heroine, and eventually she's forced to confront that anger in a final act that is among the most bonkers things I've seen on a movie screen in quite some time. Like the last 20 minutes, it just gets like, I mean, we get some body horror stuff, and it just really gets very visceral and intense in ways that are not going to be comfortable for everyone. So if you don't have a high tolerance for that sort of Cronenbergian kind of body horror type stuff, this movie might not be for you.
Okay.
Just because of that, the intensity, particularly in that final act. But all that being said, this is a Garland is a masterful visual stylist when it comes to conveying these sorts of ideas, whether you're talking about Ex Machina or Annihilation or this film. And he's also clearly very interested in power dynamics, particularly the power dynamics that come from interpersonal relationships between men and women. And this is sort of, I think, the culmination of that exploration that he's sort of, that he's done in his previous work. It's really powerful stuff. Like the point of comparison that I kept coming back to, even though I think they're very different movies, is Mother, the Darren Aronofsky movie from a few years back. Again, kind of a non-traditional narrative. It's not necessarily about plot. Like this movie isn't all that interested in explaining to you what is happening. It's more just asking you to go along for the ride and experience it in the moment without having your having any sort of like guide as to the why. Like you see what, but you don't necessarily get the why. And it's a dangerous game. Like I personally really enjoy it when you don't have that sort of hand-holding. However, it has to be well executed, or otherwise you're just left with a mess, an incoherent mess. This movie is not incoherent. It just doesn't tell a story in the same sort of way that maybe you would be expecting. It's really good. Like, it stayed with me in the days since I saw it. Really affecting. Jesse Buckley is an incredible actress. Rory Kinnear really crushes it. He is tasked with a particularly difficult performance, having to sort of spread himself so thinly, but it all works. It's all really impactful. It really thoughtful, philosophically challenging, and it's a movie that has something to say. Whether or not you might not necessarily understand what it's saying, but it's very very distinct in its viewpoint. And well, honestly, like it's nice to see something like that get a big release, even if it isn't going to necessarily pull in the numbers that that your Downton Abbeys and comic book movies will.
All right, and now in one of the stranger segues, we go from that to Chip and Dale.
Look, my understanding of this movie kind of came in stages. First, you hear, oh, they're going to do a Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers movie. Super. Like, that's just what we need. And then you hear, John Mulaney and Andy Samberg are going to be the voices of Chip and Dale. Okay. Oh, Akiva Schaffer is going to direct of Lonely Island fame. Okay. It's drawing inspiration from films like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. existing in a world where cartoons and humans operate side by side. And we're going to satirize the toxicity of nostalgia and Hollywood's obsession with the reinvestigation of intellectual property. And I'm like, all right, damn it, Disney Plus, let's do this. It feels weird to even say it. It's really good. It's really good. Like, it's smart. The jokes are good. It's not necessarily a all ages kind of film. Like, it is very much aimed at the people who watched the original show when they were kids, and sort of bringing it into a sort of modern context. So the plot is basically, as I said, this is a world where cartoon characters and humans exist side by side, and we're talking like 2D cartoons, CGI cartoons, Muppets, like the whole shebang. Like everybody exists on the same plane. And the television shows that we watch, the cartoons, they star these cartoon characters, but they are actors playing parts in these shows. Chip and Dale meet in elementary school. They immediately hit it off. They share a sense of humor. They become a sort of comedy team of sorts, and decide when they graduate from high school, they're gonna get on a bus and head to LA, and they're gonna become big stars. And so, after some time working through the biz, they get their big break, and they get the Rescue Rangers television show, which is on for 3 years, very successful. They're doing great, and then after the third season wraps, Dale springs this on Chip and says, actually, man, I think I'm going to strike out on my own. I got this offer to do a pilot. I'm going to do my own thing. And Chip's like, well, that's going to torpedo the show. And he's like, no, you guys will be fine. Flash forward 30 years later, present day. Dale has received the controversial CGI surgery. So he is no longer a 2D cartoon. He is a 3D computerized.
Wow.
Because that's a thing that you can do in this world. He is working the convention circuit. Like, he sets up a table with his merch, signing autographs, and he's there trying to sell autographs and photos and whatnot to fans at these conventions. And that's where we meet some of his some of the other cohort. My favorite being Ugly Sonic. For those who don't remember, there was a huge controversy when the first Sonic the Hedgehog movie came out, when the internet basically recoiled from Sonic's two human teeth. And so obviously they replaced it and did the movie. Well, Ugly Sonic, well, that's human teeth Sonic, voiced by Tim Robinson. Very funny. Meanwhile, Chip has gone on to become an insurance salesman. And he's very good at it. He's a regularly named employee of the month. But he's kind of lonely. He lives alone, with his dog, his normal sized regular dog, which again, hilarious, but it all gets thrown into chaos when, their old buddy from the show, Monterey Jack, voiced by Eric Bana, calls them both up separately. Because he's in trouble. He's in trouble with the Valley Gang. See, Rich, because he got in too deep. He's hooked on the stinky cheese, Rich, and he just kept going and going. And now he's worried they're going to kidnap him and bootleg him.
Oh,
see, because bootlegging is a thing where, because again, we have the CGI surgery technique. They will kidnap classic tunes, alter them just enough, and then put them to work in Romania, making like knockoff versions of their classic cartoons.
Wow.
It's
someone put some thought into this, didn't they?
Yes. And the ringleader of the whole thing, I'm not going to tell you who it is. It is a classic character, voiced by Will Arnett, but I'm not going to tell you who it is because it's a nice reveal. It may already be in the trailers or something like that, but I'm not going to be the one to spoil it. But it is someone, you'll see him, and you'll be like, oh, okay, this all tracks. And so Monty gets kidnapped. The police are called, including Captain Putty, a Gumby-like character, Claymation, voiced by J.K. Simmons, because J.K. Simmons is here.
Oh, man.
And Yeah, and so there's the one sort of human person is a detective who works for the police department. She tells Chip and Dale, well, I don't know if we can really help you, but maybe if you can track down, here's some information. Maybe you can track him down yourself. And so they're back, solving mysteries. Although, again, and it gets repeated several times, they are not detectives. They are actors who played detectives on a television show. And it kind of goes from there. I don't want to get too far into the weeds as far as the plot is concerned, because again, some really good stuff is happening here. It's a really well told story. It's really smart. The jokes hit. The voice talents are phenomenal. Like, it's just a stacked cast. You get a couple of a couple of familiar faces pop up and blink and you'll miss them sort of. Sort of things. Paul Rudd plays himself at one point. Chris Parnell is Dale's agent, and Seth Rogen actually has a great turn as a mid-aughts dwarf warrior character who serves as a guard, and he is from the Uncanny Valley. And there's a whole bit about the Uncanny Valley that I don't want to spoil. Again, you'll think it's hilarious if you enjoy this sort of thing. But it's just so, like, unexpectedly smart. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's just, like, obviously these guys grew up watching this show and have real affection for it and for these characters, and that's great. But it also really is a pretty well-done sort of exploration of these sort of toxic impulses that these massive studios have with regards to intellectual property. Massive studios that, I might add, include Disney.
Yeah.
And again, they don't go as hard as they could because, again, Disney.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, it's like there are moments in this movie where you're like, that are subversive enough where you're just like, man, how did they slide this by the suits at Disney? And and it's one of those things where it's like, I'm sure it's like we're in on the joke and blah blah blah, but when you've got talent like this working on a project like this, coming from a place both of affection and a desire to stick it to the man, like, you put those two things together and you get something that is really unexpected. And as someone who was a little too old to watch the show, but I had a younger sister, so that was all the excuse I needed, like, I'm familiar with this show. As someone who watched the show and loves the people who are involved with this movie, like, it just, I don't know, it just hit right for me, man.
Yeah.
Like, it really, just really, really good.
I had no interest in this film until you began, and now I really want to see it.
You should really check it out, man. Like, it's, like, you'll get a kick out of it.
Awesome. That sounds great. Thanks, Al.
My pleasure.
We'll see you Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
Alan Adams, Main Edge with us.